Iowa Republican leaders encourage wearing a mask at the Capitol, but oppose making it a mandate.
We have no way to enforce that, even if we were to say everyone in the caucus has to have a mask.
This worries Democratic leaders.
I'm concerned and want to avoid, you know, turning the legislature into a super spreader event.
Legislative leaders share their goals and concerns, and so does the governor on the podcast Under the Golden Dome. Listen to the new episode now at iowapublicradio.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guests today are analysts Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, the Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne and Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's reach out to our listeners as well. Of course, on Politics Day, your thoughts, your questions, concerns are welcome, especially now we have President Biden marking 2 weeks in office. What are your questions, concerns, thoughts? 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, we'll talk about that Senate impeachment trial due to start next week. Also, Biden's new tack on immigration. And we want to tap into Wayne and Jim's foreign policy expertise by going to talk about Russia and how much those protests we're seeing there are a threat to Putin and U.S. foreign policy towards Russia now that President Biden has taken a much different tack than former President Trump. Also, we'll address some things that are popping up in the news just within the last few minutes. We see that a top House Democrat has announced the chamber will vote to tomorrow to strip Marjorie Taylor Greene, this is the new representative from Georgia, of her committee assignments. We'll get into why a little bit later in the program. Also, this within the last few minutes, Canada today, in the last few minutes, the news breaking, the declaring the Proud Boys a terrorist entity. So they are adding this far-right group to a list that includes in Canada Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Shabaab. And of course, Proud Boys, an element in those attacks about a month ago on January 6th on our U.S. Capitol building. 1-866-780-9100. Join our conversation. Let's talk about the possible next stimulus. Democrats taking a steps to push through President Biden's $1.9 trillion economic rescue plan. Through this budget maneuver, Democrats showing Republicans they have the votes to pass their full spending bill with only Democratic backing. At the same time, we're seeing some negotiating there in the hopes of gaining Republican support. Let's listen to a little bit of Chuck Schumer from last week on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He's now the majority leader in the Senate since the Democrats have taken control narrowly. Let's listen to what he said about the importance of this economic stimulus package.
The Bureau of Economic Analysis this morning revealed that last year the economy shrank by 3.5%, the worst year for economic growth since World War II. And the first time our economy has contracted since the Great Recession. Given these economic numbers, the need to act big and bold is urgent. Given the fact that the GDP sunk by 3.5% last year, we need recovery and rescue quickly. Everywhere you look, alarm bells are ringing. Mortgage deferrals are increasing. Businesses are still closing. Schools are closed in many states. Restaurants and bars, travel are in crisis.
Okay, Chuck Schumer, that was from last week. Let's listen to some audio from Monday evening, or more recently, when 9 or 10 Republican senators met with President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris to propose an alternative bill to Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package. Republicans pushing for a $600 billion deal. Here's Senator Susan Collins of Maine speaking with members of the media following that meeting in the Oval Office.
I think it was an excellent meeting, and we're very appreciative that as his first official meeting in the Oval Office, the president chose to spend so much time with us in a frank and very useful discussion.
Okay. Jim, start us off. What do you see going on here? Where do you see this possibly or most likely ending up in the latest economic rescue plan?
Well, I don't think there's any difference between the parties in terms of the need that people have. I think what the difference is, and what has really been emphasized, is how much should it be targeted to those that are most in need, and should there be also some consideration of the amount of resources already spent. My own sense is that there's going to be, you know, they're going to reuse this, Democrats are going to use a reconciliation process. They've already started a resolution as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. That can be done quite quickly here. But my sense is that even with that, it allows, once it gets to the Senate, for example, it would not be subject to the filibuster. It would only have to be passed by a majority. But it does allow amendments. And I think that's where we might see this effort at the Democrats trying to bring in some Republicans. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that they really want to, despite what Senator Schumer said, that just simply to have the Democrats go alone. And I'm not sure even President Biden would want that, the ultimate bill, simply not to have any Republican votes. So what they might target is, for example, you know, the Republicans have talked about maybe taking out the $15 minimum wage dimension and maybe reducing the amount of unemployment by $100, and also making certain that the monies that are targeted for individuals would be focused on those that are in most need. In other words, cut down on the wage level where a person would be eligible for that stimulus money. So I think those would be kind of on the edge, mm-hmm. edges where it might occur. Republicans also talk about, of course, cutting out aid to state and local governments, but I suspect that the Democrats will hold firm on that.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, what do you have to add to what Jim just said?
Well, I very much agree with what Jim has said. One big difference is the amount of money for state and local governments. And for the Democrats, that's really important. As Jim has said, my guess is that Jim is right, that the Democrats will not give in on that. I do think that there will be, in the last analysis, some tightening up on the rules in terms of who can get a bonus check mm-hmm. Of $1,400, and that there will be tighter income limits than are in the original Biden proposal.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a moment about the political implications of the vaccination campaign going on and the difference that Biden has made in the past 2 weeks. Cases have been falling sharply. The pace of vaccination still slower than people wish, picking up evidently. Hopefully, if we keep vigilant, we'll have perhaps a turning point. Perhaps we are in the midst of the start of a turning point. Who knows? But the trends are good. However, we still have those variants posing a huge risk, a huge unknown. A flurry of developments from the president in the past 2 weeks involving vaccine production, distribution. Wayne, start us off on here. How do you notice in these first 2 weeks that Biden is taking a much different approach, seems a much more aggressive approach than former President Trump?
Well, the Trump approach very much relied on states in their own processes to distribute the vaccine. And now the Biden administration is adding a strong federal component to that. An announcement that I read yesterday that apparently they're going to send large numbers of doses to pharmacies, directly to pharmacies around the country, and then the pharmacies will then be able to distribute them to the people, and add this to the state processes, which will continue. And hopefully, as then more vaccines become available, we'll be able to vaccinate more people. And the numbers have started to increase. I think that the question is how fast can the production increase, and how fast can we get the vaccines to the pharmacies that they can then get out to the American people?
Right. Of course, ending this pandemic, preventing further deaths, the number one priority here. But as this is a political show, Jim, you must have thoughts on the political repercussions for elected officials as this pandemic, hopefully, a big hopefully there, winds down in the coming months.
Well, yeah, I think the implication is that any elected official really has to be really concerned that he or she can help get some resolution of this. I think what Wayne was saying is terribly important. You know, looking at the list of pharmacies that will now get it, you know, previously it was just Walgreens and CVS were involved. And now this list that the Biden administration puts out is got it runs to actually a couple pages here of the number of pharmacies. So I think it will be incumbent upon really officials at the state level too, because, you know, still, even though there's this federal effort here, and in terms of increased production, and President Biden announced, I think a week ago, that the government's going to be purchasing more supply of vaccine and so on, the distribution of this is still going to be left at the state level here. There's not going to be this kind of federal enforcement here. Mm-hmm. And so it really will be incumbent in terms talking about the political implications for governors and local officials to really be responsive to their constituencies here. I mean, there certainly can be the prodding, at least I would see at the federal level in terms of, say, the House or the Senate or the executive branch has been carried through. But I think it'll still be the execution of this, or the implementation of this vaccination campaign will still be at the state level.
If you just joined us, that's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. You're just listening to Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, professor of political science at Grinnell College. We'd love to hear from you. About a half a dozen topics. We'll veer into foreign policy later in the hour, talking about Russia and those protests here. But the first part of the hour, keeping with the significant number of domestic political developments, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about the impeachment trial due to begin next week, next Tuesday. IPR having due to have live coverage of that impeachment trial. No details on that yet as far as the time that it will start. But as we heard in our news, gentlemen, the body of Brian Sicknick, the Capitol Police officer who died from injuries sustained in that riot January 6th, lying in honor at the Capitol in the same rotunda where we had the marauding rioters. Six deaths because of that assault on the Capitol about a month ago. In their first impeachment filings, Donald Trump's lawyers denying that he incited that assault and arguing that the Constitution did not permit the Senate to try a former president. House impeachment managers asserting that history supported the Senate's right to try a former president, said that the former president, Trump, was, in their words, singularly responsible for the riot. Jim, since a conviction, from what we can tell now, is unlikely, how do you see the Democrats, see what the Democrats are trying to do here?
Well, I'm really interested to see exactly how long this trial goes on and the, sort of the depth of it. But I think that by if you look at the sort of the 80-page statement that the Democratic members put out that are prosecuting the case, it's really quite a, you know, quite a broadside against the president, former president here, and I think that they're going to probably try to use this in terms of some sort of political outcome as best they can. I mean, the aim, ultimate aim is, has been stated, is really so that Trump will not be a candidate again. And perhaps even if he were convicted, although that's unlikely, that somehow the evidence that they put forward makes it so damning, if you will, that Trump will not have any effort, any hope of sort of resurrecting his position here. But it'll be interesting to see, I think, how long this goes on and sort of the depth of the, if they really call witnesses or if they just use some of their statements as part of the indictment here.
Mm-hmm. Would take two-thirds of senators, 67 votes to attain a conviction. That means 17 Republicans crossing party lines to side with the Democrats, finding Trump guilty. If they did, that's an incredibly big if, an additional vote would be needed to disqualify him from ever holding office again. But that would be a simple majority vote. Wayne, what do you have your eyes on as we anticipate this trial starting in a few days?
Well, I think what the Democrats, and this builds on what Jim is saying, I think what the Democrats are trying to do is bring home to the full American public just how serious that riot actually was and just exactly what happened. I mean, it's been written about in newspapers and so on, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera. I'm not sure the full dimensions of that have been brought home to the American people. And I do think that Jim is right, that this is to try to make it impossible for Trump to run for political office again. I suspect that even though the Republicans will not convict him, that many of them will be quite happy to see Trump depart from the political scene. There are quite a number of other Republican potential presidential candidates, Marco Rubio, to mention one, who, as long as Trump is a possibility for the 2024 nomination, mm-hmm. will find it hard to get into the Republican race.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Talk in the last 5 minutes before this break about, the continuing flurry of executive orders from President Biden. In his first 2 weeks, President Biden signing nearly as many executive orders as Franklin Roosevelt signed in his entire first month. President Roosevelt still holding the record. Yesterday, Biden adding his signature to 3 executive orders on immigration. He now has signed 28 executive orders since taking office. FDR signed 30 in his first month. Let's talk about immigration quickly. He ordered a review of asylum processing at the U.S.-Mexican border and the immigration system. He's seeking to undo some of former President Trump's hardline policies. Biden signing those 3 executive orders, including one that aims to reunite migrant families that the Trump administration separated. Wayne, talk about, I guess you could call it somewhat of a tightrope that the president must be walking, reversing hardline Trump policies he vigorously disagrees with, while simultaneously trying to prevent a surge in illegal immigration, right? Wayne?
No, that's correct. And the question is, how will he be able to, in fact, tighten border security? A lot can be done electronically, but the pressures will probably be greater. And certainly as the economy improves, there's likely to be even more pressures. The other thing that I think that he will do, and we'll see how well this works, is, of course, send aid and assistance to the countries in Central America where these immigrants are coming from, and hopefully do some things that might improve conditions there, creating less of an incentive for people to leave those countries and to try to come into the United States. It is, in fact, a very tight rope. On the other hand, allowing Muslims to immigrate to the country, allowing the Dreamers to stay, there's some very positive things that the Biden policies can do as well.
Jim, I was struck a brief announcement by the president in signing these 3 executive orders that have to do with immigration, and the tone of these orders differing dramatically from the former president's incendiary immigration rhetoric. He ran on this. He campaigned on it. He was, has a broad a base of support for the hardline immigration stance that he took in his 4 years. The new president saying, securing our borders does not require us to ignore the humanity of those who seek to cross them. Jim, your reaction to these moves by the president on immigration?
Well, I think it really reflects what President Biden has been concerned about from the Trump administration, is that there's not been really the policies that reflect American values at work here. And what he's trying to do is to reverse some of these actions and have them more comport with the United States, obviously, as an immigrant society. I mean, that's how we started out. That's a source of strength. The problem is how to manage this. And one of the things about the executive orders that was signed yesterday, which is interesting, is that they mostly direct at studying these kind of issues. They do not immediately call for the uniting of families. I mean, certainly that's the goal. There's no question about it. And the idea of creating a better asylum policy. But you'll notice also, even the Biden press secretary came out and said, they're not really calling for people and they're trying to hold back of people immediately coming to the border because mm-hmm. they haven't got this these kind of efforts in place. And so I think, and I was reading some commentary this morning, that some groups, some immigration groups are not entirely satisfied with what Biden has done in the sense that he has, yes, moved in the right direction, taken the right steps, but he has not really fully implemented it. And so it's going to take time. So yeah. It is, I think, and to use the metaphor that Wayne was talking about, the tightrope here really continues, it seems to me, for the Biden administration. Yes, in terms of his basic values, his basic belief structure, Biden wants to get this done. But the question is, how can you effectively do this? And also, there's the other issue that really is not mentioned often, of course, is how do you deal with COVID-19 with any kind of immigration policy?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's easy to see that if Biden fails to prevent surges in illegal immigration with this new not ignoring humanity, in his words, if the surges come back to the U.S.-Mexican border, we know what part of the campaign in 2022 in those congressional elections will be about, right, Jim? We were going to break, but I assume you thought about that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, already, some of the members in Texas and so on are very much, and Arizona have been very outspoken about that.
Okay, we'll take a break and come back with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. It's Politics Wednesday edition of our program. When we come back, we'll talk about Liz Cheney of Wyoming and also this new member of Congress, a Republican from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene. A lot of actions being taken there. I'll describe them when we come back. We'll get our analyst views. Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. I'm Ben Kiefer, River to River, the program you're tuned into over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. Our analysts this week, Wayne Moyer, professor of political science at Grinnell College, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. As usual, moving through about a half dozen top items on our political landscape. Later, we'll go to foreign policy, talk about those protests in Russia, how big a threat they are to President Putin in Russia. But today, let's talk about this. Today, Republicans in the U.S. Congress meeting behind closed doors about a couple of their GOP members facing questions about whether to discipline a pair of very different representatives. Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the number three ranking Republican in the House. Marjorie Taylor Greene, a freshman representative from Georgia. Cheney facing heat for her vote to impeach former President Trump on a charge of inciting insurrection. Green on the hot seat for having supported conspiracy theories, online calls for violence against Democrats. Her views even drawing some sharp criticism from the Senate Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, who warned against, in his words, loony lies and conspiracy theories. Let's just recount very quickly on the Marjorie Taylor Greene front here. As a candidate, she endorsed executing Democratic politicians before she was elected, suggested that Muslims do not belong in government, thinks black people are, in her words, held slaves to the Democratic Party, called George Soros, a Jewish Democratic mega donor, a Nazi, said she would feel proud to see a Confederate monument if she were black because it symbolizes progress made since the Civil War. Let's listen to a bit of audio from this video posted to Twitter on January 7th, where Green called for the storming of the U.S. Capitol building.
If we have a sea of people, if we shut down the streets, if we shut down everything, if we flood the Capitol building, flood all the government buildings, go inside. These are public buildings. We own them. We own these buildings. Do you understand that? We own the buildings and we pay all the people that work in the buildings.
Okay, let's talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene. First of all, Wayne, what are the crossroads Republicans are reaching with dealing with her? We saw on the top of our news there that the congressional Republicans voting to take a public stand on this Georgia freshman who endorsed conspiracy theories. So the news moving on that.
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on here. I think what really is important is, in a way, this is a struggle between the Trump base, which is represented by Marjorie Taylor Greene, and the Republican establishment, which is represented by Lynn Cheney, or Cheney, Representative Cheney. And Republicans are trying to hold the party together, which is going to be difficult. You have the suburban Republicans on one hand, who are very much on the side of Cheney, and the Republican Party is worried about losing those. On the other hand, it wants to keep the Trump base. And if the party can't stay together, the party will not be able to win in national elections. But will you be able to keep a party together when the differences are as great as those are between Representative Cheney and Taylor Greene? I think it's an incredibly difficult task that the Republicans are facing in trying to hold themselves together as we go toward the 2022 elections.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I'm sure you've seen the same or had the same thoughts here when I've been reading up on this. Nearly every article, news article, recalls that in early 2019, then Representative Steve King of Iowa's 4th District was stripped of his committee assignments after he was found to have uttered racist comments. He was, of course, defeated in the Republican primary last June, Randy Feenstra holding the seat that he used to. Your thoughts on where the Republicans here, the dilemma they find themselves in and how they're dealing with it so far?
Well, I think they really probably have to move to strip Representative Greene of at least one of her committee assignments. And they're talking about education and labor. I suspect that will happen. I mean, I think Wayne's right. You know, there is this struggle between sort of the Trump base and the more traditional Republican Party. But what also, and they want to keep the Trump base, but what's more important is also, or not more, at least equally important, is independence here in terms of winning subsequent seats here. And Green's sort of you know, views here are so out of the mainstream here that that's going to affect independents. So I think stripping her of one of her committee assignments, you know, is probably one of the moves that they will make. I can't imagine that they will move against Liz Cheney in terms of, you know, she's the third ranking, I think, in the Republican conference. And I really doubt that they will move against her over this vote. They may, you know, they may slap her on the wrist in terms of saying, you know, that she was only one of 10 Republicans that voted on the impeachment side. I think the Green challenge is much greater for them. Mm. And I think the sort of the Steve King model is the one that will be followed.
Mm-hmm. House Democrats holding a slimmer majority than prior to the election in the House. The latest, they're preparing to advance legislation today, relieving Green of her committee assignments if House Republicans do not act promptly. Some Democrats calling for her to be expelled from Congress. Wayne, I mean, she has endorsed executing Democratic politicians before she was elected. I mean, you have to ask, if that doesn't get you serious consideration for expelling from Congress, what does?
Well, it certainly is a reason to expel her from Congress. I think there is a real would be a real problem if the Democrats were to be the ones that initiated this. For the politicians of one party to force politicians of another party to give up their committee assignments, I think is unprecedented, it leaves open the possibility in the future that parties in power might strip committee assignments from members of the other party who are actually very important members of committees. So I don't think this is a precedent we want to set.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. A little over 10 minutes left of our hour. Wayne Moyer with us and Jim McCormick, Wayne of Grinnell College, Jim of Iowa State University. Let's go abroad. Yesterday, a Russian court jailing the Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, the opposition politician, blamed the, I guess he was given over a 3-year sentence on President Putin's personal hatred and fear of him. In that coverage yesterday, the decision following nationwide protests calling for Navalny's release, the West considering sanctions on Russia over its handling of the case. The new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said Washington would coordinate closely with allies to hold Russia accountable. Let's listen to some audio from the new White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki, speaking with reporters regarding President Biden's first phone call with Vladimir Putin. During this call, Biden emphasized several areas of concern he had with Russia's recent behavior, both abroad and domestic. Let's listen.
He called him, President Putin this afternoon with the intention of discussing our willingness to extend New START for 5 years and also to reaffirm our strong support for Ukraine's sovereignty in the face of Russia's ongoing aggression, and also to raise matters of concern, including the Solar Winds hack, reports of Russia placing bounties on United States soldiers in Afghanistan, interference in the 2020 election, the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, and treatment of peaceful protesters by Russian security forces. His intention was also to make clear that the United States will act firmly in defense of our national interests in response to malign actions by Russia.
Okay, quite a list there. Jen Psaki has, the White House press secretary. Jim, we're hearing much different tone from this president than the previous.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, I think it will be incumbent upon the United States to actually take some action. Hopefully, and I think this will be a test again for President Biden, if he can get the Europeans to go along, the EU, in terms of additional sanctions. Now, I'm not being Pollyannish about whether these sanctions will really have very much impact on Russia, but I think as a symbolic kind of effort, really some actions have to be taken, and it would be really a good opportunity for the Biden administration to step forward, that they can unite with the allies in terms of taking a coordinated set of actions. I mean, there is legislation on the books already in terms of the Magnitsky Act, which was passed back in 2016, in which for these kind of human rights violations, which this case involves, that they could impose some sanctions. So I'm hoping that beyond sort of the protest and the unacceptability kind of statements, that there's some actions, even if it's of the symbolic nature.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to some words from Alexei Navalny from past months. So he's jailed now in Russia, returning there from Germany after being poisoned and then recuperating in Germany. This is audio from November of 2020, last year, Alexei Navalny testifying in front of the European Parliament virtually, urging them to stop coddling Russian oligarchs, to enforce Russian sanctions against corrupt behavior. And he says, listen here, these sanctions should specifically target Vladimir Putin and his inner circle.
A question we should ask ourselves, why these people poisoning, killing, and fabricating election? And the answer is very, very simple, money. So European Union should target the money. And Russian oligarchs, not just old oligarchs, but also new ones, like this circle of Mr. Putin, they must be real targets of sanction. And let me say it's very straight. Until the most expensive yacht of Mr. Usmanov standing in Barcelona or in Monaco, no one in Russia or in Kremlin even, they not treat European sanction seriously. They just think that they are playing European Union because they are afraid of apply real sanction against real money. So that have to be a focus. And believe me, that type of sanction would be absolutely welcome among 99% of population.
Okay, that's Alexei Navalny in November of last year. Wayne, real sanctions against real money, in Navalny's words. Well, they would at least have a symbolic nature. Jim was talking about that, but could they really cut into the oligarchy in Russia?
I think it would be a long haul. Russia produces oil and gas, and countries need oil and gas. And somebody will pay to buy them. And will you be able to really exercise massive financial leverage when the number of countries that need to buy oil and gas, Russia is as large as it is? And Putin, the other thing that I think is terribly important here is Putin controls really all of the mechanisms of the state. I think we're going to see an increasingly repressive Putin. And even though this is enormous resistance to him, I think it will be very difficult to unseat him and to unseat the oligarchs around him.
Mm-hmm. You must both also be astounded. I am astounded at the courage of Navalny here, arrested on January 17th for these alleged parole violations after returning from Germany, where he'd been recovering from being poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent, really returning into the den of the lion. Navalny saying that Russian state security agents had put the poison in his underpants, something the Kremlin has denied. And he used yesterday's hearing to try to frame Putin's place in history. Here's a quote from Navalny yesterday before putting back in jail. Putin's only method is killing people. However much he pretends to be a great geopolitician, he'll go down in history as a poisoner. There was Alexander the Liberator, Yaroslav the Wise, and Putin, the underwear poisoner. a quote from Navalny yesterday, Jim. So there you have a comment on this person and the popular appeal we think he has. It's very hard to measure public opinion in Russia, but we see it with the number of people on the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, the nerve and courage that he demonstrates, the intestinal fortitude, I guess, that he had. I mean, he knew when he was flying back to Moscow that he was going to be arrested. And you may recall he was immediately arrested when he landed at the airport over this rather bogus charge that he had not reported to his probation officer when he had been, you know, in the hospital in Germany, and he had missed the probation reporting period apparently by a day or two here. And so he was immediately taken into custody here. And now not only was he sentenced yesterday, but there's another report that there's maybe a longer sentence coming for him. So he clearly is, in terms of profiles and courage, I mean, here is a real example of profiles and courage. And you mentioned the protests. What struck me was that over 100 cities in Russia had protests over this. And this had been going on for two weekends solid, apparently, here. So, you know, that shows you the kind of affection and impact that he has, and also the amount of affection, if you will, on the other side in terms of Putin. But as Wayne correctly points out, I mean, the way that Putin controls the whole machinery of government and outcomes there makes it very difficult to have an impact. And I was struck by the Russian foreign minister statement yesterday when she announced, you know, this is domestic interference in our affairs, you know, and it's sort of kind of this typical authoritarian kind of response. You know, in terms of any kind of questioning of this internal behavior. So I hope that we can get the Europeans together. But as Wayne pointed out, you know, there's gas and oil and this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, you know, from Russia to Germany is still an issue. And that, you know, may be part of this if in fact there would be enough courage on part of the Western Europeans to do anything.
A final comment, since we're in the land of foreign policy with you two. We don't have much time, really a minute or two left, but the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar, formerly Burma, the news there for months, Myanmar's military has claimed without any evidence that its poor performance in the country's November parliamentary elections was the result of voter fraud. This week, when the new parliament was scheduled to convene, the military launched a coup. It detained top of civilian officials, also including the state counselor Aung San Suu Kyi. Wayne, quickly, how much of a surprise is this coup? The implications for this fledgling democracy in part of the world where authoritarian leadership is the rule, right?
Yes. Well, the military really never gave up control, and Aung San Suu Kyi was very limited in what she could do. And now the United States made a bet that democracy could succeed, but the military clearly was not willing to let it go any further. And it's going to be very sad for the people in Myanmar because this regime is both terribly corrupt and has led to enormous hardship. And then there's the Rohingya genocide as mm-hmm. well, for which it is responsible.
Yeah. The final minute to Jim, to comment on Myanmar.
Yeah, what struck me and what I still want to sort of find out is how much China knew about this, because it turns out the report was that the general who is now leading the country had actually met with a Chinese official a week or two before the coup. And, you know, I think it's probably the case that China does not want to see any example of a democracy functioning on their border. Plus also, you know, Myanmar is crucially important in terms of the Road and Belt Initiative, and particularly for for China maybe getting access to the Indian Ocean. There's always been the talk of this railroad and maybe more. And so it'll be interesting to see if this also was part of the Chinese trying to at least accommodate their influence in that particular area of the world.
Okay. Jim McCormick, Wayne Moyer, we'll have to leave it there. Another Politics Wednesday. Thank you for your expertise. Wayne Moyer, Professor of Rosenfield, Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stay healthy, be well, and until our next Politics Day, thank you very much, Wayne and Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank Ben.
And tomorrow on the program, I'll be away. We'll have a special edition of Witness from History from the BBC World Service at this time, bringing together some really incredible interviews looking at the African-American experience to mark Black American Month. NASA's pioneering Black woman will be talked about in a number of other areas. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.